this nut. Shagger will go with the boy man, and if the boy man lies, Shagger will chop off his manhood.
And feed it to the goats, yes, Tyrion said wearily. Shagger, I give you my word as a Lannister. I will return. Why should we trust your word?
Chilla was a small, hard woman, flat as a boy and no fool.
Lowland lords have lied to the clans before.
You wound me, Chilla, Tyrion said.
Here I thought we had become such good friends, but as you will. You shall ride with me, and Shagger and Conn for the Stone Crows, Ulf for the Moon Brothers, and Timmet, son of Timmet, for the Burned Men.
The clansmen exchange wary looks as he named them.
The rest shall wait here until I send for you. Try not to kill and maim each other while I'm gone.
He put his heels to his horse and trotted off, giving them no choice but to follow or be left behind. Either was fine with him, so long as they did not sit down to talk for a day and a night. That was the trouble with the clans. They had an absurd notion that every man's voice should be heard in council, so they argued about everything endlessly. Even their women were allowed to speak. Small wonder that it had been hundreds of years since they had last threatened the Vale with anything beyond an occasional raid. Tyrion meant to change that. Bronn rode with him. Behind them, after a quick bit of grumbling, the five clansmen followed, on their undersized garrons, scrawny things that looked like ponies and scrambled up rock walls like goats. The Stone Crows rode together, and Chilla and Ulf stayed close as well, as the Moon Brothers and Black Ears had strong bonds between them. Timmet, son of Timmet, rode alone. Every clan in the Mountains of the Moon feared the Burned Men, who mortified their flesh with fire to prove their courage, and, the other said, roasted babies at their feasts. And even the other Burned Men feared Timmet, who had put out his own left eye with a white-hot knife when he'd reached the age of manhood. Tyrion gathered that it was more customary for a boy to burn off a nipple, a finger, or, if he was truly brave or truly mad, an ear. Timmet's fellow Burned Men were so awed by his choice of an eye that they promptly named him a Red Hand, which seemed to be some sort of war chief.
"I wonder what their king burned off," Tyrion said to Bronn when he heard the tale.
Grinning, the sellsword had tugged at his crutch. But even Bronn kept a respectful tongue around Timmet. If a man was mad enough to put out his own eye, he was unlikely to be gentle to his enemies. Distant watchers peered down from towers of unmortared stone as the party descended through the foothills, and once Tyrion saw a raven take wing. Where the high road twisted between two rocky outcrops, they came to the first strong point. A low earthen wall, 4 feet high, closed off the road, and a dozen crossbowmen manned the heights. Tyrion halted his followers, out of range, and rode to the wall alone.
"Who commands here?"
he shouted up. The captain was quick to appear, and even quicker to give them an escort when he recognized his lord's son. They trotted past blackened fields and burned holdfasts, down to the riverlands and the green fork of the Trident. Tyrion saw no bodies, but the air was full of ravens and carrion crows. There had been fighting here, and recently. Half a league from the crossroads, a barricade of sharpened stakes had been erected, manned by pikemen and archers. Behind the line, the camp spread out to the far distance. Thin fingers of smoke rose from hundreds of cook fires. Mailed men sat under trees and honed their blades, and familiar banners fluttered from staffs thrust into the muddy ground. A party of mounted horsemen rode forward to challenge them as they approached the stakes. The knight who led them wore silver armour inlaid with amethysts and a striped purple and silver cloak. His shield bore a unicorn sigil, and a spiral horn 2 feet long jutted out from the brow of his horse-head helm. Tirion reined up to greet him. "Sir Flemont!" Sir Flemont Brax lifted his visor.
"Tirion," he said in astonishment, "my lord, we all feared you dead,
He looked at the clansman uncertainly.
"These companions of yours?"
"Bosom friends and loyal retainers," Tirion said. "Where will I find my lord father?"
"He has taken the inn at the crossroads for his quarters."
Tirion laughed. "The inn at the crossroads. Perhaps the gods were just after all."
"I will see him at once."
"As you say, my lord."
Sir Flemont wheeled his horse about and shouted commands. 3 rows of stakes were pulled from the ground to make a hole in the line. Tirion led his party through. Lord Tywin's camp spread over leagues. Chella's estimate of 20,000 men could not be far wrong. The common men camped out in the open, but the knights had thrown up tents, and some of the high lords had erected pavilions as large as houses. Tirion spied the red ox of the Prestors, Lord Crakehall's brindle boar, the burning tree of Marbrand, the badger of Lydon. Knights called out to him as he cantered past, and men-at-arms gaped at the clansmen in open astonishment. Shagger was gaping back. Beyond a certainty, he had never seen so many men, horses, and weapons in all his days. The rest of the mountain brigands did a better job of guarding their faces, but Tirion had no doubts that they were full as much in awe. Better and better, the more impressed they were with the power of the Lannisters, the easier they would be to command. The inn and its stables were much as he remembered, though little more than tumbled stones and blackened foundations remained where the rest of the village had stood. A gibbet had been erected in the yard, and the body that swung there was covered with ravens. At Tyrion's approach, they took to the air, squawking and flapping their black wings. He dismounted and glanced up at what remained of the corpse. The birds had eaten her lips and eyes and most of her cheeks, baring her stained red teeth in a hideous smile. "A room, a meal, and a flagon of wine? That was all I asked," he reminded her with a sigh of reproach. Boys emerged, hesitantly, from the stables to see to their horses. Shagger did not want to give his up.
"The lad won't steal your mare," Tirion assured him. "He only wants to give her some oats and water and brush out her coat."
Shagger's coat could have used a good brushing, too, but it would have been less than tactful to mention it.
"You have my word. The horse will not be harmed."
Glaring, Shagger let go of his grip on the reins.
"This is the horse of Shagger, son of Dolph,"
he roared at the stable boy.
"If he doesn't give her back, chop off his manhood and feed it to the goats,"
Tirion promised.
"Providing you can find some."
A pair of house guards in crimson cloaks and lion-crested helms stood under the inn sign on either side of the door. Tirion recognized their captain.
"My father?"
"In the common room, my lord."
"My men will want meat and mead," Tirion told them. "See that they get it."
He entered the inn, and there was father. Tywin Lannister, lord of Casterly Rock and warden of the West, was in his middle 50s, yet hard as a man of 20. Even seated, he was tall, with long legs, broad shoulders, a flat stomach. His thin arms were corded with muscle. When his once thick golden hair had begun to recede, he had commanded his barber to shave his head. Lord Tywin did not believe in half measures. He razored his lips and chin as well, but kept his side whiskers, two great thickets of wiry golden hair that covered most of his cheeks from ear to jaw. His eyes were a pale green, flecked with gold. A fool, more foolish than most, had once jested that even Lord Tywin's shit was flecked with gold. Some said the man was still alive, deep in the bowels of Casterly Rock. Sir Kevin Lannister, his father's only surviving brother, was sharing a flagon of ale with Lord Tywin when Tyrion entered the common room. His uncle was portly and balding, with a close-cropped yellow beard that followed the line of his massive jaw. Sir Kevin saw him first. "Tyrion!" he said in surprise.
"Uncle," Tyrion said, bowing, "and my lord father, what a pleasure to find you here."
Lord Tywin did not stir from his chair, but he did give his dwarf son a long, searching look.
"I see that the rumors of your demise were unfounded."
"Sorry to disappoint you, father," Tyrion said.
"No need to leap up and embrace me. I wouldn't want you to strain yourself."
He crossed the room to their table, acutely conscious of the way his stunted legs made him waddle with every step. Whenever his father's eyes were on him, he became uncomfortably aware of all his deformities and shortcomings.
"Kind of you to go to war for me," he said, as he climbed into a chair and helped himself to a cup of his father's ale.
"By my lights, it was you who started this," Lord Tywin replied. "Your brother, Jaime, would never have meekly submitted to capture at the hands of a woman."
"That's one way we differ, Jaime and I. He's taller as well, you may have noticed."
His father ignored the sally.
"The honor of our house was at stake. I had no choice but to ride. No man sheds Lannister blood with impunity."
"Hear me roar,"
Tyrion said, grinning. The Lannister words.
"Truth be told, none of my blood was actually shed, although it was a close thing once or twice. Morak and Jick were killed."
"I suppose you'll be wanting some new men."
"Don't trouble yourself, father. I've acquired a few of my own."
He tried a swallow of the ale. It was brown and yeasty, so thick you could almost chew it. Very fine, in truth. A pity his father had hanged the innkeeper.
"How is your war going?"
His uncle answered, "Well enough for the nonce. Sir Edmure had scattered some troops of men along his borders to stop our raiding, and your lord father and I were able to destroy most of them piecemeal before they could regroup."
"Your brother has been covering himself with glory," his father said. "He smashed the lords Vance and Piper at the Golden Tooth, and met the massed powers of the Tullys under the walls of Riverrun. The lords of the Trident have been put to rout. Sir Edmure Tully was taken captive, with many of his knights and bannermen. Lord Blackwood led a few survivors back to Riverrun, where Jaime has them under siege. The rest fled to their own strongholds."
"Your father and I have been marching on each in turn," Sir Kevin said. "With Lord Blackwood gone, Raventree fell at once, and Lady Went yielded Harrenhal for want of men to defend it. Sir Gregor burnt out the Pipers and the Brackens."
"Leaving you unopposed,"
Tyrion said.
"Not wholly," Sir Kevin said. "The Malaster still holds Seaguard, and Walder Frey is marshalling his levies at the Twins."
"No matter," Lord Tywin said. "Frey only takes the field when the scent of victory is in the air, and all he smells now is ruin. And Jason Malaster lacks the strength to fight alone. Once Jaime takes River Run, they will both be quick enough to bend the knee. Unless the Starks and the Aerons come forth to oppose us, this war is good as won."
I would not fret overmuch about the Aerons, if I were you," Tyrion said. "The Starks are another matter. Lord Eddard
is our hostage," his father said.
He will lead no armies while he rots in a dungeon under the Red Keep.
No, Sir Kevin agreed. But his son has called the banners and sits at Moat Cailin with a strong host around him.
No sword is strong until it's been tempered, Lord Tywin declared. The Stark boy is a child. No doubt he likes the sound of war horns well enough, and the sight of his banners fluttering in the wind. But in the end, it comes down to butcher's work. I doubt he has a stomach for it.
Things had gotten interesting while he'd been away, Tyrion reflected. And what is our fearless monarch doing, whilst all this butcher's work is being done? He wondered. How has my lovely and persuasive sister gotten Robert to agree to the imprisonment of his dear friend Ned?
Robert Baratheon is dead, his father told him. Your nephew reigns in King's Landing.
That did take Tyrion aback. My sister, you mean? He took another gulp of ale. The realm would be a much different place, with Cersei ruling in place of her husband.
If you have a mind to make yourself of use, I will give you a command, his father said. Mark Piper and Carol Vance are loose in our rear, raiding our lands across the Red Fork.
Tyrion made a tisking sound.
The gall of them fighting back. Ordinarily, I'd be glad to punish such rudeness, father, but the truth is, I have pressing business elsewhere.
Do you?
Lord Tywin did not seem awed.
We also have a pair of Ned Stark's afterthoughts, making a nuisance of themselves by harassing my foraging parties. Beric Dondarrion, some young lordling with delusions of valor. He has that fat jape of a priest with him, the one who likes to set his sword on fire. Do you think you might be able to deal with them as you scamper off without making too much of a botch of it?
Tyrion wiped his mouth with the back of his hand and smiled.
Father, it warms my heart to think that you might entrust me with, what, 20 men? 50? Are you sure you can spare so many? Well, no matter. If I come across Thoros and Lord Beric, I shall spank them both.
He climbed down from his chair and waddled to the sideboard, where a wheel of veined white cheese sat surrounded by fruit.
First, though, I have some promises of my own to keep, he said as he sliced off a wedge. I shall require 3,000 helms and as many hauberks, plus swords, pikes, steel spearheads, maces, battle axes, gauntlets, gorgets, greaves, breastplates, wagons to carry all this.
The door behind him opened with a crash, so violently that Tyrion almost dropped his cheese. Sir Kevin leapt up swearing as the captain of the guard went flying across the room to smash against the hearth. As he tumbled down into the cold ashes, his lion helm askew, Shagger snapped the man's sword in two over a knee thick as a tree trunk, threw down the pieces, and lumbered into the common room. He was preceded by his stench, riper than the cheese, and overpowering in that closed space.
"Little red cape," he snarled. "When next you bear steel on Shagger, son of Dolph, I will chop off your manhood and roast it in the fire."
"What, no goats?" Tyrion said, taking a bite of cheese. The other clansmen followed Shagger into the common room, Bronn with them. The sellsword gave Tyrion a rueful shrug.
"Who made you be?"
Lord Tywin asked, cool as snow.
"They followed me home, father," Tyrion explained. "May I keep them? They don't eat much."
No one was smiling.
"By what right do you savages intrude in our councils?" demanded Sir Kevin. "Savages, Lowlander?
Cun might have been handsome if you washed him.
We are free men, and free men, by rights, sit on all war councils.
Which one is the landlord?
Chella asked.
They are both old men, announced Timot, son of Timot, who had yet to see his 20th year.
Sir Kevin's hand went to his sword hilt, but his brother placed two fingers on his wrist and held him fast. Lord Tywin seemed unperturbed.
Tyrion, have you forgotten your courtesies? Kindly acquaint us with our honored guests.
Tyrion licked his fingers.
With pleasure, he said. The fair maid is Chella, daughter of Cheek of the Black Years.
I'm no maid,
Chella protested.
My sons have taken 50 years among them.
May they take 50 more.
Tyrion waddled away from her.
This is Conn, son of Carat. Shagar, son of Dolph, is the one who looks like Casterly Rock with hair. They are stone crows. Here is Ulf, son of Umar of the Moon Brothers. Here is Timet, son of Timet, a red hand of the Burn Men. And this is Brun, a sellsword of no particular allegiance. He has already changed sides twice in the short time I've known him.
You and he ought to get on famously, father.
To Brun and the clansmen he said,
May I present my lord father, Tywin, son of Tytos, of House Lannister, lord of Casterly Rock, warden of the West, shield of Lannisport, and once and future and of the king.
Lord Tywin rose, dignified and correct.
Even in the West, we know the prowess of the warrior clans of the Mountains of the Moon. What brings you down from your strongholds, my lords?
Horses, said Shagger.
A promise of silk and steel, said Timot, son of Timot. Tyrion was about to tell his lord father how he proposed to reduce the Vale of Arryn to a smoking wasteland, but he was never given the chance. The door banged open again. The messenger gave Tyrion's clansman a quick, queer look as he dropped to one knee before Lord Tywin.
My lord, he said, Sir Adam bid me tell you that the Stark Host is moving down the causeway.
Lord Tywin Lannister did not smile. Lord Tywin never smiled. But Tyrion had learned to read his father's pleasure all the same, and it was there on his face.
So the wolfling is leaving his den to play among the lions, he said in a voice of quiet satisfaction. Splendid! Return to Sir Adam and tell him to fall back. He is not to engage the northerners until we arrive, but I want him to harass their flanks and draw them farther south.
It will be as you command,
the rider took his leave.
We are well situated here, Sir Kevin pointed out, close to the ford and ringed by pits and spikes. If they are coming south, I say let them come and break themselves against us.
The boy may hang back or lose his courage when he sees our numbers, Lord Tywin replied. The sooner the Starks are broken, the sooner I shall be free to deal with Stannis Baratheon. Tell the drummers to beat assembly and send word to Jaime that I am marching against Robb Stark.
As you will, Sir Kevin said.
Tyrion watched with a grim fascination as his lord father turned next to the half-wild clansmen.
It is said that the men of the mountain clans are warriors without fear. It is said truly,
Conn of the Stone Crows answered.
And the women,
Chella added.
Ride with me against my enemies, and you shall have all my son promised you, and more,
Lord Tywin told them.
Would you pay us with our own coin?
Ulf, son of Umar, said.
Why should we need the father's promise
when we had the sons.
I said nothing of need, Lord Tywin replied. My words were courtesy, nothing more. You need not join us. The men of the Winterlands are made of iron and ice, and even my boldest knights fear to face them.
Oh, deftly done, Tyrion thought, smiling crookedly.
The Burn Man fear nothing. Timmit, son of Timmit, will ride with the lions. Wherever the Burn Man go, the Stone Crows have been there first, Conn declared hotly. We ride as well. Shagga, son of Dolph, will chop off their manhoods and feed them to the crows.
We will ride with you, landlord, Chella, daughter of Cheek, agreed. But only if your half-man son goes with us. He has bought his breath with promises. Until we hold the steel, he has pledged us. His life is ours.
Lord Tywin turned his gold-flecked eyes on his son.
Joy,
Tyrion said, with a resigned smile. Sansa. The walls of the throne room had been stripped bare, the hunting tapestries that King Robert loved taken down and stacked in the corner in an untidy heap. Sir Mandon Moore went to take his place onto the throne beside two of his fellows of the King's Guard. Sansa hovered by the door, for once unguarded. The Queen had given her freedom of the castle as a reward for being good, yet even so she was escorted everywhere she went. Honor guards for my daughter-to-be, the Queen called them, but they did not make Sansa feel honored. Freedom of the castle meant that she could go wherever she chose, within the Red Keep, so long as she promised not to go beyond the walls, a promise Sansa had been more than willing to give. She couldn't have gone beyond the walls anyway. The gates were watched day and night by Jaina Slynt's gold cloaks, and Lannister house guards were always about as well. Besides, even if she could leave the castle, where would she go? It was enough that she could walk in the yard, pick flowers in Marcella's garden, and visit the Sept to pray for her father. Sometimes she prayed in the Godswood as well, since the Starks kept the old gods. This was the first court session of Joffrey's reign. So Sansa looked about nervously. A line of Lannister house guards stood beneath the western windows, a line of gold-cloaked city watchmen beneath the east. Of small folk and commoners she saw no sign. But under the gallery a cluster of lords, great and small, milled restlessly. There were no more than 20, where 100 had been accustomed to wait upon King Robert. Sansa slipped in among them, murmuring greetings as she worked her way toward the front. She recognized black-skinned Jalabar Zo, gloomy Sir Aaron Santagar, the Red Wine twins, Horror and Slobber. Only none of them seemed to recognize her, or if they did, they shied away as if she had the grey plague. Sickly Lord Giles covered his face at her approach and feigned a fit of coughing, and when funny, drunken Sir Dontus started to hail her, Sir Balon Swan whispered in his ear, and he turned away. And so many others were missing. Where had the rest of them gone? Sansa wondered. Vainly she searched for friendly faces. Not one of them would meet her eyes. It was as if she had become a ghost, dead before her time. Grand Maester Pycelle was seated alone at the council table, seemingly asleep, his hands clasped together atop his beard. She saw Lord Varys hurry into the hall, his feet making no sound. A moment later, Lord Baelish entered through the tall door in the rear, smiling. He chatted amiably with Sir Balon and Sir Dontus as he made his way to the front. Butterflies fluttered nervously in Sansa's stomach. I shouldn't be afraid, she told herself. I have nothing to be afraid of. It will all come out well. Joff loves me, and the Queen does too. She said so. A herald's voice rang out. All hail his grace, Joffrey of the houses Baratheon and Lannister, the first of his name, King of the Andals, the Rhoynar, and the First Men, and Lord of the Seven Kingdoms, all hail his Lady Mother, Cersei of House Lannister, Queen Regent, Light of the West, and Protector of the Realm.
Sir Barristan Selmy, resplendent in white plate, led them in. Sir Aerys Oakheart escorted the Queen, while Sir Boris Blunt walked beside Geoffrey. So six of the King's guards were now in the hall, all the white swords, save Jaime Lannister alone. Her prince, no, her king now, took the steps of the Iron Throne two at a time, while his mother was seated with the council. Joff wore plush black velvets slashed with crimson, a shimmering cloth of gold cape with a high collar, and on his head a golden crown crusted with rubies and black diamonds. When Joffrey turned to look out over the hall, his eye caught Sansa's. He smiled, seated himself, and spoke. "It is a king's duty to punish the disloyal and reward those who are true. Grand Maester Pycelle, I command you to read my decrees." Pycelle pushed himself to his feet. He was clad in a magnificent robe of thick red velvet, with an ermine collar and shiny gold fastenings. From a drooping sleeve heavy with gilded scrollwork, he drew a parchment, unrolled it, and began to read a long list of names, commanding each, in the name of king and council, to present themselves and swear their fealty to Joffrey. Failing that, they would be judged traitors, their lands and titles forfeit to the throne. The names he read made Sansa hold her breath. Lord Stannis Baratheon, his lady wife, his daughter. Lord Renly Baratheon. Both Lord Royces and their sons. Sir Loras Tyrell. Lord Mace Tyrell, his brothers, uncles, sons. The Red Priest, Thoros of Myr. Lord Beric Dondarrion. Lady Lysa Arryn and her son, the little Lord Robert. Lord Huster Tully, his brother, Sir Brynden, his son, Sir Edmure. Lord Jason Mallister. Lord Bryce Caron of the Marches. Lord Titus Blackwood. Lord Walder Frey and his heir, Sir Stevron. Lord Carol Vance. Lord Jonas Bracken. Lady Shella Went. Doran Martell, Prince of Dawn, and all his sons. So many, she thought, as Pycelle read on and on. It will take a whole flock of ravens to send out these commands. And at the end, near last, came the name Sansa had been dreading. Lady Catelyn Stark, Robb Stark, Brandon Stark, Rickon Stark, Arya Stark. Sansa stifled a gasp. Arya? They wanted Arya to present herself and swear an oath? It must mean her sister had fled on the galley. She must be safe at Winterfell by now. Grand Maester Pycelle rolled up the list, tucked it up his left sleeve, and pulled another parchment from his right. He cleared his throat and resumed.
"In the place of the traitor, Eddard Stark, it is the wish of his grace that Tywin Lannister, Lord of Casterly Rock and Warden of the West, take up the office of Hand of the King to speak with his voice, lead his armies against his enemies, and carry out his royal will. So the King has decreed. The small council consents. In the place of the traitor Stannis Baratheon, it is the wish of his grace that his lady mother, the Queen Regent Cersei Lannister, who has ever been his staunchest support, be seated upon his small council, that she may help him rule wisely and with justice. So the king has decreed. The small council consents.
Sansa heard a low murmuring from the lords around her, but it was quickly stilled. Pycelle continued.
It is also the wish of his grace, that his loyal servant, Janus Slint, commander of the city watch of King's Landing, be at once raised to the rank of lord and granted the ancient seat of Harrenhal, with all its attendant lands and incomes, and that his sons and grandsons shall hold these honours after him until the end of time. It is moreover his command that Lord Slint be seated immediately upon his small council to assist in the governance of the realm. So the king has decreed. The small council consents.
Sansa glimpsed motion from the corner of her eye as Janus Slint made his entrance. This time the muttering was louder and angrier. Proud lords whose houses went back thousands of years made way reluctantly for the balding, frog-faced commoner as he marched past. Golden scales had been sewn onto the black velvet of his doublet and rang together softly with each step. His cloak was checked black and gold satin. Two ugly boys, who must have been his sons, went before him, struggling with the weight of a heavy metal shield as tall as they were. For his sigil he had taken a bloody spear, gold on a night-black field. The sight of it raised goose prickles up and down Sansa's arms. As Lord Slint took his place, Grand Maester Pycelle resumed.
"Lastly, in these times of treason and turmoil, with our beloved Robert so lately dead, it is the view of the council that the life and safety of King Joffrey is of paramount importance."
He looked to the Queen. Cersei stood. "Sir Barristan Selmy, stand forth." Sir Barristan had been standing at the foot of the Iron Throne as still as any statue. But now he went to one knee and bowed his head.
"Your Grace, I am yours to command."
"Rise, Sir Barristan," Cersei Lannister said. "You may remove your helm."
"My lady."
Standing, the old knight took off his high white helm, though he did not seem to understand why. "You have served the realm long and faithfully, good sir, and every man and woman in the Seven Kingdoms owes you thanks. Yet now I fear your service is at an end. It is the wish of king and council that you lay down your heavy burden."
My burden? I fear I do not..."
The new-made lord, Janus Slint, spoke up, his voice heavy and blunt.
"Her Grace is trying to tell you that you are relieved as Lord Commander of the King's Guard."
The tall, white-haired knight seemed to shrink as he stood there, scarcely breathing.
"Your Grace," he said at last, "the King's Guard is a sworn brotherhood. Our vows are taken for life. Only death may relieve the Lord Commander of his sacred trust."
"Whose death, Sir Barristan?" The Queen's voice was soft as silk, but her words carried the whole length of the hall.
"Yours or the King's?" "You let my father die," Joffrey said accusingly from atop the Iron Throne. "You're too old to protect anybody."
Sansa watched as the knight peered up at his new king. She had never seen him look his years before, yet now he did.
"Your Grace," he said, "I was chosen for the White Swords in my 23rd year. It was all I had ever dreamed. From the moment I first took sword in hand, I gave up all claim to my ancestral keep. The girl I was to wed married my cousin in my place. I had no need of land or sons. My life would be lived for the realm. Sir Gerald Hightower himself heard my vows, to ward the king with all my strength, to give my blood for his. I fought beside the White Bull and Prince Lewin of Dawn, beside Sir Arthur Dane, the Sword of the Morning. Before I served your father, I helped shield King Aerys and his father, Jaehaerys, before him. Three kings."
"And all of them dead," Littlefinger pointed out. "Your time is done," Cersei Lannister announced. "Joffrey requires men around him who are young and strong. The council has determined that Sir Jaime Lannister will take your place as the Lord Commander of Sworn Brothers of the White Swords."
"The Kingslayer?"
Sir Barristan said, his voice hard with contempt.
"The false knight who profaned his blade with the blood of the king he had sworn to defend?"
"Have a care for your words, sir," the queen warned. "You are speaking of our beloved brother, your king's own blood." Lord Varys spoke, gentler than the others.
"We are not unmindful of your service, good sir. Lord Tywin Lannister has generously agreed to grant you a handsome tract of land north of Lannisport, beside the sea, with gold and men sufficient to build you a stout keep, and servants to see to your every need."
Sir Barristan looked up sharply.
"A hall to die in, and men to bury me. I thank you, my lords, but I spit upon your pity."
He reached up and undid the clasps that held his cloak in place, and the heavy white garment slithered from his shoulders to fall in a heap on the floor. His helmet dropped with a clang.
"I am a knight," he told them.
He opened the silver fastenings of his breastplate and let that fall as well.
"I shall die a knight."
"A naked knight, it would seem," quipped Littlefinger.
They all laughed then. Joffrey on his throne, and the lords standing attendance, Janus Slint, and Queen Cersei, and Sandor Clegane, and even the other men of the King's Guard, the five who had been his brothers until a moment ago. Surely that must have hurt the most, Sansa thought. Her heart went out to the gallant old man as he stood shamed and red-faced, too angry to speak. Finally, he drew his sword. Sansa heard someone gasp. Sir Boris and Sir Meryn moved forward to confront him, but Sir Barristan froze them in place with a look that dripped contempt.
"Have no fear, sirs. Your king is safe. No thanks to you. Even now I could cut through the five of you as easy as a dagger cuts cheese. If you would serve under the Kingslayer, not a one of you is fit to wear the white."
He flung his sword at the foot of the Iron Throne.
"Here, boy, melt it down, and add it to the others if you like. It will do you more good than the swords in the hands of these five. Perhaps Lord Stannis will chance to sit on it when he takes your throne."
He took the long way out, his steps ringing loud against the floor and echoing off the bare stone walls. Lords and ladies parted to let him pass. Not until the pages had closed the great oak and bronze doors behind him did Sansa hear sounds again. Soft voices, uneasy stirrings, the shuffle of papers from the council table.
"He called me boy," Joffrey said peevishly, sounding younger than his years. "He talked about my uncle Stannis, too."
"Idle talk," said Varys the eunuch, "without meaning.
He could be making plots with my uncles. I want him seized and questioned."
No one moved. Joffrey raised his voice.
"I said I want him seized."
Janus Slint rose from the council table.
"My gold cloaks will seat at your grace."
"Good,"
said King Joffrey. Lord Janus strode from the hall, his ugly sons double-stepping to keep up as they lugged the great metal shield with the arms of House Slint.
"Your Grace,"
Littlefinger reminded the king,
"if we might resume, the seven on our six, we find ourselves in need of a new sword for your king's guard."
Joffrey smiled. "Tell them, mother. The king and the council have determined that no man in the Seven Kingdoms is more fit to guard and protect his grace than his sworn shield, Sandor Clegane."
"How do you like that, dog?"
King Joffrey asked. The hound's scarred face was hard to read. He took a long moment to consider.
"Why not? I have no lands nor wife to forsake. And who'd care if I did?"
The burn side of his mouth twisted.
"But I warn you, I'll say no knight's vows."
"The sworn brothers of the King's Guard have always been knights," Sir Boris said firmly.
"Until now," the hound said,
in his deep rasp, and Sir Boris fell silent. When the King's Herald moved forward, Sansa realized the moment was almost at hand. She smoothed down the cloth of her skirt nervously. She was dressed in mourning, as a sign of respect for the dead king. But she had taken special care to make herself beautiful. Her gown was the ivory silk that the queen had given her, the one Arya had ruined. But she'd had them dye it black, and you couldn't see the stain at all. She had fretted over her jewelry for hours and finally decided upon the elegant simplicity of a plain silver chain. The herald's voice boomed out. "If any man in this hall has other matters to set before his grace, let him speak now, or go forth and hold his silence." Sansa quailed. "Now," she told herself, "I must do it now. God's give me courage." She took one step, then another. Lords and knights stepped aside, silently, to let her pass, and she felt the weight of their eyes on her. "I must be as strong as my lady mother." "Your Grace," she called out in a soft, tremulous voice. The height of the Iron Throne gave Joffrey a better vantage point than anyone else in the hall. He was the first to see her. "Come forward, my lady," he called out, smiling. His smile emboldened her, made her feel beautiful and strong. "He does love me, he does." Sansa lifted her head and walked toward him, not too slow and not too fast. She must not let them see how nervous she was. "The Lady Sansa of House Stark," the herald cried. She stepped under the throne, at the spot where Sir Barristan's white cloak lay puddled on the floor beside his helm and breastplate. "Do you have some business for king and council, Sansa?" the queen asked from the council table. "I do." She knelt on the cloak, so as not to spoil her gown, and looked up at a prince on his fearsome black throne. "As it please your grace, I ask mercy for my father, Lord Eddard Stark, who was the hand of the king." She had practiced the words 100 times. The queen sighed. "Sansa, you disappoint me. What did I tell you about traitor's blood?"
"Your father has committed grave and terrible crimes, my lady,"
Grand Maester Pycelle intoned.
"Our poor sad king," sighed Varys. "She is only a babe, my lord. She does not know what she asks."
Sansa had eyes only for Joffrey.
"He must listen to me. He must," she thought.
The king shifted on his seat.
"Let her speak," he commanded. "I want to hear what she says."
"Thank you, your grace." Sansa smiled, a shy, secret smile, just for him. He was listening. She knew he would.
"Treason is a noxious weed," Pycelle declared solemnly. "It must be torn up, root and stem and seed, lest new traitors sprout from every roadside."
"Do you deny your father's crime?" Lord Baelish asked.
No, my lords. Sansa knew better than that. "I know he must be punished. All I ask is mercy. I know my lord father must regret what he did. He was King Robert's friend, and he loved him. You all know he loved him. He never wanted to be hanged until the king asked him."
"They must have lied to him. Lord Renly or Lord Stannis or somebody. They must have lied, otherwise..."
King Joffrey leaned forward, hands grasping the arms of the throne. Broken sword points fanned out between his fingers.
"He said I wasn't the king. Why did he say that?"
"His leg was broken," Sansa replied eagerly. "It hurt ever so much. Maester Pycelle was giving him milk of the poppy, and they say that milk of the poppy fills your head with clouds. Otherwise he would never have said it."
Varys said, "A child's faith, such sweet innocence. And yet they say wisdom oft comes from the mouths of babes."
"Treason is treason," Pycelle replied at once.
Joffrey
rocked restlessly on his throne. "Mother?" Cersei Lannister considered Sansa thoughtfully. "If Lord Eddard were to confess his crime," she said at last, "we would know he had repented his folly." Joffrey pushed himself to his feet.
"Please," Sansa thought, "please, please be the king. I know you are good and kind and noble. Please."
"Do you have anything more to say?" he asked her. "Only that as you love me, you do me this kindness, my prince," Sansa said. King Joffrey looked her up and down.
"Your sweet words have moved me," he said gallantly, nodding as if to say all would be well. "I shall do as you ask. But first your father has to confess. He has to confess and say that I'm the king, or there will be no mercy for him."
"Oh, he will," Sansa said, heart soaring. "Oh, I know he will."
Eddard. The straw on the floor stank of urine. There was no window, no bed, not even a slop bucket. He remembered walls of pale red stone, festooned with patches of nitre, a grey door of splintered wood, 4 inches thick and studded with iron. He had seen them, briefly, a quick glimpse as they shoved him inside. Once the door had slammed shut, he had seen no more. The dark was absolute. He had as well been blind. Or dead. Buried with his king.
"Ah, Robert,"
he murmured, as his groping hand touched a cold stone wall, his leg throbbing with every motion. He remembered the jest the king had shared in the crypts of Winterfell, as the kings of Winter looked on with cold stone eyes.
"The king eats," Robert had said, "and the hand takes the shit."
How he had laughed. Yet he had gotten it wrong. "The king dies," Ned Stark thought, "and the hand is buried." The dungeon was under the Red Keep, deeper than he dared imagine. He remembered the old stories about Maegor the Cruel, who murdered all the masons who labored on his castle, so they might never reveal its secrets. He damned them all. Littlefinger, Janus Slint, in his gold cloaks, the Queen, the Kingslayer, Pycelle, and Varys, and Ser Barristan, even Lord Renly, Robert's own blood, who had run when he was needed most. Yet in the end, he blamed himself. "Fool!" he cried to the darkness. "Thrice damn blind fool!" Cersei Lannister's face seemed to float before him in the darkness. Her hair was full of sunlight, but there was mockery in her smile.
"When you play the Game of Thrones, you win or you die," she whispered.
Ned had played and lost, and his men had paid the price of his folly with their life's blood. When he thought of his daughters, he would have wept gladly, but the tears would not come. Even now he was a Stark of Winterfell, and his grief and his rage froze hard inside him. When he kept very still, his leg did not hurt so much, so he did his best to lie unmoving. For how long he could not say. There was no sun and no moon. He could not see to mark the walls. Ned closed his eyes and opened them. It made no difference. He slept and woke and slept again. He did not know which was more painful, the waking or the sleeping. When he slept, he dreamed. Dark, disturbing dreams of blood and broken promises. When he woke, there was nothing to do but think, and his waking thoughts were worse than nightmares. The thought of Cat was as painful as a bed of nettles. He wondered where she was, what she was doing. He wondered whether he would ever see her again. Hours turned to days, or so it seemed. He could feel a dull ache in his shattered leg, an itch beneath the plaster. When he touched his thigh, the flesh was hot to the fingers. The only sound was his breathing. After a time, he began to talk aloud, just to hear a voice. He made plans to keep himself sane, build castles of hope in the dark. Robert's brothers were out in the world raising armies at Dragonstone and Storm's End. Alan and Harwin would return to King's Landing with the rest of his household guard once they had dealt with Sir Gregor. Catelyn would raise the north when the word reached her, and the lords of river and mountain and vale would join her. He found himself thinking of Robert more and more. He saw the king, as he had been in the flower of his youth, tall and handsome, his great antlered helm on his head, his war hammer in hand, sitting his horse like a horned god. He heard his laughter in the dark, saw his eyes blue and clear as mountain lakes. "Look at us, Ned," Robert said. "Gods, how do we come to this? You here, and me, killed by a pig. We won a throne together." "I failed you, Robert," Ned thought. He could not say the words. "I lied to you, hid the truth. I let them kill you." The king heard him. "You stiff-necked fool," he muttered. "Too proud to listen. Can you eat pride, Stark? Will honor shield your children?" Cracks ran down his face, fissures opening in the flesh, and he reached up and ripped the mask away. It was not Robert at all. It was Littlefinger, grinning, mocking him. When he opened his mouth to speak, his lies turned to pale grey moths and took wing. Ned was half asleep when the footsteps came down the hall. At first he thought he'd dreamt them. It had been so long since he had heard anything but the sound of his own voice. Ned was feverish by then, his leg a dull agony, his lips parched and cracked. When the heavy wooden door creaked open, the sudden light was painful to his eyes. A jailer thrust a jug at him. The clay was cool and beaded with moisture. Ned grasped it with both hands and gulped it eagerly. Water ran from his mouth and dripped down through his beard. He drank until he thought he would be sick. "How long?" he asked weakly when he could drink no more. The jailer was a scarecrow of a man with a rat's face and frayed beard, clad in a mail shirt and a leather half-cape. "No talking," he said, as he wrenched the jug from Ned's hands. "Please," Ned said, "my daughters." The door crashed shut. He blinked as the light vanished, lowered his head to his chest, and curled up on the straw. It no longer stank of urine and shit. It no longer smelled at all. He could no longer tell the difference between waking and sleeping. The memory came creeping upon him in the darkness, as vivid as a dream. It was the year of full spring, and he was 18 again, down from the Eyrie to the Tawny at Harrenhal. He could see the deep green of the grass and smell the pollen on the wind. Warm days and cool nights and the sweet taste of wine. He remembered Brandon's laughter and Robert's berserk valour in the melee, the way he laughed as the unhorsed men left and right. He remembered Jaime Lannister, a golden youth in scaled white armour, kneeling on the grass in front of the king's pavilion and making his vows to protect and defend King Aerys. Afterward, Sir Oswald went, helped Jaime to his feet, and the White Ball himself, Lord Commander Sir Gerald Hightower, fastened the snowy cloak of the king's guard about his shoulders. All six white swords were there to welcome their newest brother. Yet when the jousting began, the day belonged to Rhaegar Targaryen. The crown prince wore the armour he would die in, gleaming black plate with a three-headed dragon of the house wrought in rubies on the breast. A plume of scarlet silk streamed behind him when he rode, and it seemed no lance could touch him. Brandon fell to him, and Bronze Yon Royce,
and even the splendid Sir Arthur Dane, the Sword of the Morning. Robert had been jesting with John, an old Lord Hunter, as the prince